It is a long way to Ankh Morpork, said Unity.
We'll have a lift, said Susan. The first stars were already coming out.
The stars are very pretty, said Unity.
Do you really think so?
I am learning to. Humans believe they are.
The thing is, I mean, there's times when you look at the universe and you think, what about me? And you can just hear the universe replying, well, what about you? Unity appeared to consider this.
Well, what about you? She said.
Susan sighed.
Exactly, she sighed again.
You can't think about just one person while you're saving the world. You have to be a cold, calculating bastard.
That sounded as if you were quoting somebody, said Unity. Who said that?
Some total idiot, said Susan. She tried to think of other things and added, we didn't get all of them. There's still auditors down there somewhere.
That will not matter, said Unity calmly. Look at the sun.
Well?
It is setting.
And?
That means time is flowing through the world. The body exacts its toll, Susan. Soon my former colleagues, bewildered and fleeing, will become tired. They will have to sleep.
I follow you, but...
I am insane, I know this. But the first time it happened to me, I found such horror that I cannot express it. Can you imagine what it is like? For an intellect a billion years old, in a body which is an ape on the back of a rat that grew out of a lizard? Can you imagine what comes out of the dark places, uncontrolled?
What are you telling me?
They will die in their dreams.
Susan thought about this. Millions and millions of years of thinking precise, logical thoughts. And then humanity's murky past drops all its terrors on you in one go. She could almost feel sorry for them. Almost. But you didn't, she said.
No, I think I must be different. It is a terrible thing to be different, Susan. Did you have romantic hopes in connection with the boy?
The question came out of nowhere, and there was no defence. Unity's face showed nothing but a kind of nervous concern. No, said Susan. Unfortunately, Unity did not seem to have mastered some of the subtleties of human conversation, such as when a tone of voice means, stop this line of inquiry right now, or may huge rats eat you by day and by night.
I confess to strange feelings regarding his self that was the clockmaker. Sometimes, when he smiled, he was normal. I wanted to help him, because he seemed so closed in and sad.
You don't have to confess to things like that, Susan snapped. How do you even know the word romantic anyway? She added.
I found some books of poetry.
Unity actually looked embarrassed. Really? I've never trusted it, said Susan. Huge, giant, hungry rats.
I found it most curious. How can words on a page have a power like that? There is no doubt that being human is incredibly difficult and cannot be mastered in one lifetime, said Unity, sadly.
Susan felt a stab of guilt. It wasn't Unity's fault, after all. People learn things as they grow up, things that never get written down, and Unity had never grown up. What are you going to do now, she said.
I do not know. I have some skills by human standards.
Well, if I can help in any way. It was, she realized later, one of those phrases like, how are you? People were supposed to understand that it wasn't a real question, but Unity hadn't learned that either.
Thank you. You can indeed help.
Fine, if...
I wish to die.
And galloping out of the sunset, some riders were approaching. Tick! Small fires burned in the rubble, brightening the night. Most of the houses had been completely destroyed, although, Soto considered, the word shredded was much more accurate. He was sitting by the side of the street, watching carefully with his begging bowl in front of him. There were, of course, far more interesting and complex ways for a history monk to avoid being noticed, but he'd adopted the begging bowl method ever since Lutse had shown him that people never see anyone who wants them to give him money. He'd watched the rescuers drag the bodies out of the house. Initially, they'd thought that one of them had been hideously mutilated in the explosion, until it had sat up and explained that it was an Igor, and in very good shape for an Igor at that. The other he'd recognised as Dr. Hopkins, the Guild of Clockmakers, who was miraculously unharmed. Soto did not believe in miracles, however. He was also suspicious about the fact that the ruined house was full of oranges, that Dr. Hopkins was babbling about getting sunlight out of them, and that his sparkling little abacus was telling him that something enormous had happened. He decided to make a report and see what the boys at Oi Dong said. Soto picked up the bowl and set off through the network of alleys back to his base. He didn't bother much about concealment now. Lutsei's time in the city had been a process of accelerated education for many citizens of the lurking variety. The people of Ankh-Morpork knew all about Rule 1. At least they had known until now. Three figures lurched out of the dark, and one of them swung a length of wood, which would have connected with Soto's head if he hadn't ducked. He was used to this sort of thing, of course. There was always the occasional slow learner, but they presented no peril that a neat slice couldn't handle. He straightened up, ready to ease his way out of there, and a thick lock of black hair fell onto his shoulder, slithered down his robe and flopped onto the ground. It made barely a sound, but the expression on his face, as Soto looked down and then up at his attackers, made them draw back. He could see, through the blood-red rage, that they all wore stained grey clothes and looked even crazier than the usual alley people. They looked like accountants gone mad. One of them reached out towards the begging bowl. Everyone has a conditional clause in their life, some little unspoken additional to the rules like, except when I really need to, or unless no one is looking, or indeed, unless the first one was a nougat. Soto had for centuries embraced a belief in the sanctity of all life and the ultimate uselessness of violence. But his personal conditional clause was, but not the hair. No one touches the hair, okay? Even so, everyone ought to have a chance. The attackers recoiled as he threw the bowl against the wall, where the hidden blades bedded themselves in the woodwork. Then it began to tick. Soto ran back down the alley, skidded around the corner, and then shouted, Duck! Unfortunately for the auditors, alas, he was just a tiny, tiny fraction of a second too late. Tick! Lutsei was in his Garden of Five Surprises when the air sparkled and fragmented and swirled into a shape in front of him. He looked up from his ministrations to the yodeling stick insect who'd been off his food. Lobsang stood on the path. The boy was wearing a black robe dotted with stars, which blew and rattled its rags around him on this windless morning, as if he was standing in the centre of a gale. Which, Lutsei supposed, he more or less was.
Back again, wonder boy, said the sweeper.
In a way, I never leave, said Lobsang.
Things have gone well with you. Don't you know?
I could. But part of me has to do this the traditional way.
Well, the abbot is mighty suspicious, and there's some more amazing rumours flying around the place. I didn't say much. What do I know about anything? I'm just a sweeper.
With that, Lutsei turned his attention to the stick insect. He'd counted to four under his breath before Lobsang said, Please, I have to know. I believe that the fifth surprise is you. Am I right? Lutsei cocked his head. A low noise, which he'd heard for so long he no longer consciously heard it, had changed its tone.
The spinners are all winding out, he said. They know you're here, lad.
I shall not be here long. Sweeper, please.
You just want to know my little surprise.
Yes, I know nearly everything else, said Lobsang.
But you are time. What I tell you in the future, you'll know now, right?
But I'm partly human. I want to stay partly human. That means doing things the right way round. Please. Lutsei sighed and looked for a while down the avenue of cherry blossom.
When a pupil can beat the master, there is nothing the master cannot tell him, he said. Remember?
Yes.
Very well. The iron dojo should be free.
Lobsang looked surprised.
The iron dojo? Isn't that the one with all the sharp spikes in the walls?
And the ceiling, yes. The one that's like being inside a giant porcupine turned inside out?
Lobsang looked horrified.
But that's not for practice. The rules say
that's the one, said Lutsei. And I say we use it.
Oh,
good. No argument, said Lutsei. This way, lad.
Blossom cascaded from the trees as they passed. They entered the monastery and took the same route they'd taken once before. This brought them into the Hall of the Mandala, and the sand rose like a dog welcoming its master and spiralled in the air far below Lobsang's sandals. Lutsei heard the shouts of the attendants behind him.
News like this spread throughout the valley like ink in water. Hundreds of monks, apprentices and sweepers were trailing the pair as they crossed the inner courtyards, like the tail of a comet. Above them, all the time, petals of cherry blossom fell like snow. At last, Lutze reached the high, round metal door of the iron dojo. The clasp of the door was 15 feet up. No one was supposed to open the door of the dojo who did not belong there. The sweeper nodded at his former apprentice.
"You do it," he said. "I can't."
Lobsang glanced at him and then looked up at the high clasp. Then he pressed a hand against the iron. Rust spread under his fingers. Red stains spread out across the ancient metal. The door began to creak and then to crumble. Lutze prodded it with an experimental finger, and a slab of biscuit-strong metal fell out and collapsed on the flagstones.
"Very impressed,"
he began. A squeaky rubber elephant bounced off his head.
"Biscuit!"
The crowd parted. The chief acolyte ran forward, carrying the abbot.
"What is the one a biscuit, biscuit, meaning of this? Who is what a funny man, this person, sweeper? The spinners are dancing in their hall."
Lutze bowed.
"He is time, reverend one, as you have suspected," he said.
Still bent in the bow, he looked up and sideways at Lobsang.
"Bow," he hissed.
Lobsang looked puzzled.
"I should bow even now," he said. "Bow, you little stonger, or I shall teach you such discipline. Show deserved respect. You are still my apprentice until I give you leave."
Shocked, Lobsang bowed.
"And why do you visit us in our timeless valley?" said the abbot. "Tell the abbot,"
Lutze snapped. I wish to learn the fifth surprise," said Lobsang.
"Reverend one,"
said Lutze. "Reverend one," Lobsang finished.
"You visit us just to learn of our clever sweeper's fancies?" said the abbot.
"Yes, Reverend one."
"Of all the things time could be doing, you wish to see an old man's trick?"
"Biscuit!"
"Yes, Reverend One." The monks stared at Lobsang. His robe still fluttered this way and that in the teeth of the intangible gale, the stars glinting when they caught the light. The abbot smiled a cherubic smile.
"So should we all," he said. "None of us has ever seen it, I believe. None of us has ever been able to wheedle it out of him. But this is the Iron Dojo. It has rules. Two may walk in, but only one can walk out. Well, this is no practice dojo." "One elephant!"
"You understand?" "What? I didn't know..." Lobsang began, but the sweeper jerked an elbow into his ribs.
"You'll say yes, Reverend One," he growled.
"But I never intended..." This time the back of his head was slapped.
"This is no time to step back," Lutze said. "You're too late, Wonder Boy."
He nodded to the abbot.
"My apprentice understands, Reverend One."
"Your apprentice, sweeper?"
"Oh, yes, Reverend One," said Lutze. "My apprentice, until I say otherwise."
"Really?
Biscuit!"
"Then he may enter."
"You too, Lutze."
"But I only meant to..." Lobsang protested.
"Inside!" Lutze roared. "Will you shame me? Shall people think I have taught you nothing?"
The inside of the iron dojo was indeed a darkened dome full of spikes. They were needle-thin, and there were tens of thousands of them covering the nightmare walls. "Who would build something like this?" said Lobsang, looking up at the glistening points that covered even the ceiling.
"It teaches the virtues of stealth and discipline," said Lutze, cracking his knuckles. "Impetuosity and speed can be as dangerous to the attacker as to the attacked, as perhaps you will learn. One condition, we are all human here, agreed?"
"Of course, sweeper, we are all human here."
"And we shall agree no tricks?"
"No tricks," said Lobsang.
"But are we fighting or are we talking?"
"But look, if only one can walk out, that means I'll have to kill you," Lobsang began.
"Or vice versa, of course," said Lutze. "That is the rule, yes. Shall we get on?"
"But I didn't know that."
"In life, as in breakfast cereal, it is always best to read the instructions on the box," said Lutze. "This is the Iron Dojo, Wonder Boy."
He stepped back and bowed. Lobsang shrugged and bowed in return. Lutze took a few steps back.
He closed his eyes for a moment, and then went through a series of simple moves, limbering up. Lobsang winced to hear the crackle of joints. Around Lobsang there was a series of snapping noises, and for a moment he thought of the old sweeper's bones, but tiny hatches all over the curved wall were swinging open. He could hear whispers as people jostled for position, and by the sound of it, there were a great many people. He extended his hands and let himself rise gently in the air.
"I thought we said no tricks," said Lutsay.
"Yes, sweeper," said Lobsang, poised in mid-air. "And then I thought, never forget rule one."
"Aha, well done. You've learned something."
Lobsang drifted closer. "You cannot believe the things that I have seen since I last saw you," he said. "Words cannot describe them. I have seen worlds nesting within worlds, like those dolls they carve in Überwald. I have heard the music of the years. I know more than I can ever understand. But I do not know the fifth surprise. It is a trick, a conundrum, a test."
"Everything is a test," said Lutsay.
"Then show me the fifth surprise, and I promise not to harm you."
"You promise not to harm me?"
"I promise not to harm you," Lobsang repeated solemnly.
"Fine. You only had to ask," said Lutsay, smiling broadly.
"What?
I asked before and you refused. You only had to ask at the right time, Wonder Boy."
"And it is the right time now?"
"It is written, there's no time like the present," said Lutsay. "Behold the fifth surprise."
He reached into his robe. Lobsang floated closer. The sweeper produced a cheap carnival mask. It was one of those that consisted of a fake pair of spectacles glued above a big pink nose and finished with a heavy black moustache. He put it on and waggled his ears once or twice.
"Bow,"
he said.
"What?"
said Lobsang, bewildered.
"Bow,"
Lutsay repeated.
"I never said it was a particularly imaginative surprise, did I?"
He waggled his ears again and then waggled his eyebrows.
"Good, eh?"
he said and grinned. Lobsang laughed. Lutsay grinned wider. Lobsang laughed louder and lowered himself to the mat. The blows came out of nowhere. They caught him in the stomach, on the back of the neck, in the small of his back, and swept his legs from under him. He landed on his stomach, with Lutsay pinning him down in the straddle of the fish. The only way to get out of that was to dislocate your own shoulders. There was a sort of collective sigh from the hidden watchers.
"They shall fall!"
"What?" said Lobsang into the mat.
"You said none of the monks knew Deja Fu." "I never taught it to them, that's why," said Lutsay. "Promise not to harm me, would you? Thank you so very much. Submit."
"You never told me you knew it." Lutsay's knees, rammed into the secret pressure points, were turning Lobsang's arms into powerless lumps of flesh.
"I may be old, but I'm not daft," Lutsay shouted. "You don't think I'd give away a trick like that, do you?"
"That's not fair." Lutsay leaned down until his mouth was an inch from Lobsang's ear.
"Didn't say fair on the box, lad. But you can win, you know. You could turn me into dust just like that. How could I stop time?"
"I can't do that."
"You mean you won't. And we both know it. Submit."
Lobsang could feel parts of his body trying to shut themselves down. His shoulders were on fire. "I can discarnate," he thought. "Yes, I can. I could turn him into dust with a thought. And lose. I'd walk out and he'd be dead and I'd have lost."
"Nothing to worry about, lad," said Lutsay calmly now. "You just forgot Rule 19. Submit."
"Rule 19, said Lobsang, almost pushing himself off the mat until terrible pain forced him down again.
"What the hell is Rule 19? Yes, yes, submit, submit. Remember never to forget Rule 1.
Said Lutsay. He released his grip.
"And always ask yourself, how come it was created in the first place, eh?"
Lutsay got to his feet and went on.
"But you have performed well, all things considered, and therefore, as your master, I have no hesitation in recommending you for the yellow robe. Besides,"
he lowered his voice to a whisper,
"everyone peeking in here has seen me beat time, and that's the sort of thing that'll look really good on my curriculum vitae, if you catch my meaning. Definitely give old Rule One a fillip. Let me give you a hand up."
He reached down. Lobsang was about to take the hand when he hesitated. Lutse grinned again and gently pulled him upright.
"But only one of us can leave, Sweeper," said Lobsang, rubbing his shoulders.
"Really?"
said Lutse.
"But playing the game changes the rules. I say, the hell with it."
The remains of the door were pushed aside by the hands of many monks. There was the sound of someone being hit with a rubber yak.
"Big hit! And the abbot, I believe, is ready to present you with a robe," said Lutse. "Don't make any comment if he dribbles on it, please."
They left the dojo, and followed now by every soul in Oidong, headed for the long terrace. It was, Lutse reminisced later, an unusual ceremony. The abbot did not appear overawed, because babies generally aren't and will throw up over anyone. Besides, Lobsang might have been master of the gulfs of time, but the abbot was master of the valley, and therefore respect was a line that travelled in both directions. But the handing over of the robe had caused a difficult moment. Lobsang had refused it. It had been left to the chief acolyte to ask why, while the whispered currents of surprise washed through the crowd.
"I am not worthy, sir. Lutse has declared that you have completed your apprenticeship, my lord, Lobsang lad."
Lobsang bowed.
"Then I will take the broom and the robe of a sweeper, sir."
This time the current was a tsunami. It crashed over the audience. Heads turned. There were gasps of shock and one or two nervous laughs. And from the lines of sweepers, who had been allowed to pause in their tasks to watch the event, there was a watchful, intent silence. The chief acolyte licked his suddenly dehydrated lips.
But, you are the incarnation of time.
In this valley, sir, said Lobsang firmly, I am as worthy as a sweeper.
The chief acolyte looked around, but there was no help anywhere. The other senior members of the monastery had no wish to share in the huge pink cloud of embarrassment. The abbot merely blew bubbles and grinned the inward knowing grin of all babies everywhere.
"Do we have any, do we present sweepers with, do we by any chance," the acolyte mumbled.
Lutse stepped up behind him.
"Can I be of any help, your acolytality?"
he said, with a sort of mad keen subservience that was quite alien to his normal attitude.
"Lutse, I could fetch a nearly new rope, sir, and a lad can have my old broom, if you'll sign a chitty for me to get a new one from stores, sir,"
said Lutse, sweating helpfulness at every pore. The chief acolyte, drowning well out of his depth, seized on this like a passing lifebelt.
"Oh, would you be so good, Lutse? It is so kind of you."
Lutse vanished in a blur of helpful speed that once again quite surprised those who thought they knew him. He reappeared with his broom and a robe made white and thin with frequent bashings on the stones by the river. He solemnly handed them over to the chief acolyte.
Thanks. You, is there a special ceremony for
the man babbled.
"Very simple one, sir," said Lutse, still radiating eagerness. "Wording is quite loose, sir, but generally we say, this is your robe, look after it, it belongs to the monastery, sir. And then, with the broom, we say something like, here's your broom, treat it well, it is your friend, you'll be fined if you lose it. Remember, they do not grow on trees, sir."
The chief acolyte murmured.
"And does the abbot..." "Oh, no, the abbot would not make a presentation to a sweeper," said Lobsang quickly. "Lutse, who does the... It's generally done by a senior sweeper, your acolytality."
"Oh?
And, by some happy chance, you happen to be..."
Lutse bobbed about.
"Oh, yes, sir."
To the chief acolyte, still floundering in the flood of the turning tide, this was as welcome as the imminent prospect of dry land. He beamed manically.
I wonder then if you would be so kind, to..."
"Happy to, sir."
Lutse swung round.
"Right now, sir."
"Oh, please, yes."
"Right you are. Step forward, Lobsang lad."
"Yes, sweeper." Lutse held out the worn robe and the elderly broom.
"Broom, robe. Do not lose them. We are not made of money," he announced.
"I thank you for them," said Lobsang. "I am honoured."
Lobsang bowed. Lutse bowed. With their heads close together and at the same height, Lutse hissed,
"Very surprising."
"Thank you." "Nicely mythic, the whole thing. Definitely one for the scrolls, but bordering on smug. Do not try it again."
"Right." They both stood up.
"And, what happens now?" said the chief acolyte.
He was a broken man, and he knew it. Nothing was going to be the same after this.
"Nothing, really," said Lutse. "Sweepers get on with sweeping. You take that side, lad, and I'll take this."
"But he is time," said the chief acolyte. "The son of Wen. There is so much we have to ask."
"There is so much I will not tell," said Lobsang, smiling. The abbot leaned forward and dribbled in the chief acolyte's ear. He gave up.
"Of course, it is not up to us to question you," he said, backing away.
"No," said Lobsang, "it is not.
I suggest you all get on with your very important work, because this plaza is going to need all my attention."
There were frantic hand signals amongst the senior monks, and gradually, reluctantly, the monastery staff moved away.
"They'll be watching us from every place they can hide," mumbled Lutse when the sweepers were alone.
"Oh, yes," said Lobsang.
"So, how are you, then?"
"Very well. And my mother is happy, and she will retire with my father."
"What? A cottage in the country, that sort of thing?"
"Not quite. Similar, though." There was no sound for a while but the brushing of two brooms. Then Lobsang said, "I'm aware, Lutse, that it is usual for an apprentice to give a small gift or token to his master when he finishes his apprenticeship."
"Possibly," said Lutse, straightening up. "But I don't need anything. I've got my mat, my bowl, and my way."
"Every man has something he desires," said Lobsang.
"Ha! Got you there, then, wonder boy. I'm 800 years old. I've run through all my desires long ago."
"Oh, dear, that is a shame. I hoped I could find something." And now Lobsang straightened up and swung his broom onto his shoulder. "In any case, I must leave," he said. "There is so much still to do."
"I'm sure there is," said Lutse. "I'm sure there is. There's the whole stretch under the trees, for one thing. And while we're on the subject, wonder boy, did you let that witch have her broomstick back?"
Lobsang nodded. "Let us just say, I put things back. It's a lot newer than it was, too."
"Ha!"
said Lutse, sweeping up a few more petals.
"Just like that. Just like that. So easily does a thief of time repay his debts."
Lobsang must have caught the rebuke in the tone. He stared down at his feet. "Well, perhaps not all of them, I admit," he said.
"Oh?"
said Lutse, still apparently fascinated by the end of his own broom. "But when you have to save a world, you cannot think of one person, you see, because one person is a part of that world," Lobsang went on.
"Really?"
said the sweeper.
"You think so? You've been talking to some very strange people, my lad."
"But now I have time," said Lobsang earnestly, "and I hope she'll understand."
"It's amazing what a lady will understand if you find the right way of putting it," said Lutse. "Best of luck, lad. You didn't do so bad on the whole. And is it not written? There's no time like the present."
Lobsang smiled at him and vanished. Lutse went back to his sweeping. After a while, he smiled at a memory. "An apprentice gives a gift to the master, eh? As if Lutse could want anything that time could give him." And he stopped and looked up and laughed out loud. Overhead, swelling as he watched, the cherries were ripening. Tick! In some place that had not existed before, and only existed now for this very purpose, stood a large, gleaming vat.
10,000 gallons of delicate fondant sugar cream infused with essence of violet and stirred into dark chocolate, said Chaos. There are also strata of hazelnut praline in rich buttercream and areas of soft caramel for that special touch of delight.
So, you're saying that this vat could exist somewhere in a truly infinite everywhere, and therefore it can exist here, said Death.
Indeed, said Chaos.
But it no longer exists in the place where it should exist.
No, it should, now, exist here. The mass is easy, said Chaos.
Ah, well, maths, said Death dismissively. Generally, I never get much further than subtraction.
In any case, chocolate is hardly a rare commodity, said Chaos. There are planets covered in the stuff.
Really?
Indeed.
It might be best, said Death, if news like that did not get about.
He walked back to where Unity was waiting in the darkness.
You do not need to do this, he said.
What else is there? Said Unity. I have betrayed my own kind, and I am hideously insane. I can never be at home anywhere, and staying here would be an agony.
She stared into the chocolate abyss. A dusting of sugar sparkled on its surface. Then she slipped out of her dress. To her amazement, she felt embarrassed about doing so, but still drew herself up haughtily.
Spoon,
she commanded, and held out her right hand imperiously. Chaos gave a silver ladle a final theatrical polish and passed it to her.
Goodbye, said Unity. Do pass on my best wishes to your granddaughter.
She walked a few steps back, turned, broke into a run, and took off into a perfect swallow dive. The chocolate closed over her with barely a sound. Then the two watchers waited until the fat, lazy ripples had died away.
Now, there's a lady with style, said Chaos. What a waste.
Yes, I thought so.
Well, it's been fun. Up to that point, anyway. And now I must be off, said Chaos.
You're continuing with the milk round.
People rely on me.
Death looked impressed.
It's going to be interesting to have you back, he said.
Yeah, it is, said Chaos. You're not coming?
I'm going to wait here for a while.
Why?
Just in case.
Ah.
Yes.
It was some minutes later that Death reached into his robe and pulled out a lifetimer that was small and light enough to have been designed for a doll. He turned around.
But I died,
said the Shade of Unity.
Yes, said Death. This is the next part.
Tick. Emma Robertson sat in the classroom with wrinkled brow, chewing on her pencil. Then, rather slowly, but with the air of one imparting great secrets, she set to work.
We went to Lanka, where there are witches. They are kind. They grow herbs, she wrote. We met this witch. She was very joel and sang us a snog, a bot, a hedgehog. It had difficult words. Jason tried to kick her cat. It chased him up a tree. I know a lot about witches. Now they do not have warts. They do not eat you. They are just like your grain, except your grain does not know difficult words.
At her high desk, Susan relaxed. There was nothing like a classroom of bent heads. A good teacher used whatever materials there were to hand, and taking the class to visit Mrs. Ogg was an education in herself. Two educations. A classroom going well had its own smell. A hint of pencil shavings, poster paints, long-dead stick insect, glue, and, of course, the faint aroma of Billy. There had been an uneasy meeting with her grandfather. She'd raged that he hadn't told her things, and he'd said, of course he hadn't. If you told humans what the future held, it wouldn't. That made sense. Of course it made sense. It was good logic. The trouble was that Susan was only mostly logical. And so, now, things were back in that uneasy, rather cool state where they spent most of their time in the tiny little family that ran on dysfunctionality. Maybe, she thought, that was a normal family state. When push came to shove, thank you, Mrs. Ogg, she'd always remember that phrase now, they'd rely on each other automatically, without a thought. Apart from that, they kept out of one another's way. She hadn't seen the death of rats lately. It was too much to hope that he was dead. In any case, it hadn't slowed him down so far. That thought made her think about the contents of her desk. Susan was very strict about eating in class, and took the view that if there were rules, then they applied to everyone, even her. Otherwise, they were merely tyranny. But rules were there to make you think before you broke them. There was still half a box of Higgs and Meekins' cheapest assortment tucked in there amongst the books and papers. Opening the lid carefully and slipping her hand in was easy, and so was the maintenance of a suitably teachery face while she did so. questing fingers found a chocolate in the nest of empty paper cups, and told her that it was a damned nougat. But she was resolute. Life was tough. Sometimes you got nougat. Then she briskly picked up the keys and walked to the stationery cupboard with what she hoped was the purposeful step of someone about to check on the supply of pencils. After all, you never knew with pencils. They needed watching. The door clicked behind her, leaving only the dim light through the transom. She put the chocolate in her mouth and shut her eyes. A faint, cardboardy sound made her open them. The lids were lifting on the boxes of stars. They spilled out and whirled up into the shadows of the cupboard, brilliant against the darkness, a galaxy in miniature. Susan watched them for a while and then said, "All right, you have my full attention, whoever you are." At least, that was what she meant to say. The peculiar stickiness of the nougat caused it to come out as, "All right, you have my full attention, whoever you are. Damn!" The stars spiralled around her head, and the cupboard's interior darkened into interstellar black. "If this is you, deaf of rats," she began. "It's me," said Lobsang. Tick. Even with nougat, you can have a perfect moment.